This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 5th of December, 1952. The title of this lecture is Conditions of Space, Time, Energy. This lecture is 64 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is the third hour of December the 5th afternoon. We have been covering aspects of interrelated cycles of action, and we have found that by postulating or by acquiring or by assuming a new type of cycle called the tone scale, that we can bring into relationship human experience, the experience of the Thetan, and the conditions of space, time, and energy, so that by working one, we can attain another. We have set up an arbitrary crossroad by saying there is a tone scale. Now, by the introduction of that, we put up crossroads. And it must be a pretty good crossroads, because since 1950, it has been producing very good results. It is something that is accumulating data and simplifying data. As the slide rule is to the engineer, which is an arbitrary, after all, it's a logarithmic scale, so might be said the tone scale is to an auditor. It solves problems for him. And the better he knows how to use it, the better an auditor he is. This tells him that in creative processing, the mock-ups, which he addresses to the pre-clear, can go higher and higher and higher in level with great variety. If he did not give that variety, he would not maintain the interest of the pre-clear. Furthermore, if he doesn't have an existing coincidence or association between human experience and Thetan's experience and space, energy, and time, he would not be able to remedy aberration, really, in terms of the messed universe. Here we find somebody in the messed universe, and we want to know how we can either, one, improve his status in the messed universe, two, make him into a Thetan and improve the status of the Thetan in the messed universe, or three, make it possible for him to create items and objects and so forth in the messed universe, or four, make a universe of his own, or five, handle and control universes, or six, skip it. Now, he has all those various choices. And essentially, we are studying choice and intention. Now, you want to know what lies above 40. One of the things which lies above it would be intention. Now, if the intention is to have objects, well, one would go through whatever he had to go through to make the object. Or he'd just postulate there was an object there and have an object. Or if one wanted action, if his intention was action, he could have action. If his intention is just to have lots of space, he could have lots of space. Or if his intention was to continue along a subject known as progress, he could follow the cycle of action through from space to having an object. In other words, his intention in each case, continually, one after the other, could be a selective thing. Now, there's great lucidity in this. There's great fluidity. He has set himself up to agree to the arrival into the possession of an object by the adoption of a cycle of action. And he has even gone so far as to think he has to have an object to have a memory. He has manufactures in Homo sapiens, facsimiles, engrams, secondaries, locks, data, facsimiles, pictures, books, all that sort of thing, words, all these things. Now, in order to he's gone into this scale. Now, it's gotten into a gradient scale and a new scale here, quite important, the scale of automaticity. I'll have to cover that scale. And he's gotten everything to a point where it's all automatic, it's all got to be made for him, it's all got to be pre-existing objects before himself. He exists before any object exists, but he's got it so twisted by this time that the object exists before he exists. And, he's starting low and diving full throttle. And this, then, is a number of choices. So intention exists above 40.0. Other things can exist above 40.02, but intention exists. Now, he could simply say, I have action. A magician, the magic cults of the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries in the Middle East were fascinating. The only modern work that has anything to do with them is a trifle wild in spots, but it's fascinating work in itself, and that's work written by Aleister Crowley, the late Aleister Crowley, my very good friend. And he did himself a splendid piece of aesthetics built around those magic cults. It's a very interesting reading to get a hold of a copy of a book, quite rare, but it can be obtained, The Master Therion, T-H-E-R-I-O-N, The Master Therion by Aleister Crowley. He signs himself the Beast, the Mark of the Beast, 666. Very, very something or other. But anyway, the Crowley exhumed a lot of the data from these old magic cults, and he, as a matter of fact, handles cause and effect quite a bit. Cause and effect is handled according to a ritual. And it's interesting that whenever you have any of these things, you can always assign a ritual to it, and that ritual is what you do in order to accomplish this, or how you have to go through and how many motions you have to make to come into the ownership of that. And that's a ritual. Or how many motions or words you have to say in order to be something else. Now, that's a ritual. And that is each ritual is a cycle of some sort or another. Now, you can have cycles that start low and end high. But because Homo sapiens has agreed to a cycle that starts with space and ends with matter, when Homo sapiens starts into a cycle of action, he finds himself up with his hands full of gold and with shackles on every limb. Now, he continually knows completely that all he has to do is start low and go high. He knows that. He said, well, now all we have to do is go with this greatest scale. And he hasn't had a route that led through anything to reverse this cycle, because he had agreed so heavily to having the cycle of action, which is this messed universe itself. He can't bring himself to completely reverse this without backtracking the agreement cycle, merely because he's ethical and his word is good. However bad he may seem to you at this level of the tone scale, he isn't bailed out of it for one reason, and that is his word is good. Now, when he backtracks this cycle of action, he just has to back it up. And you've got start low and arrive high. And in Scientology, we have, as far as I know, in this universe, hey, as far as I know, the first time, we have a cycle of action which starts low and goes high and gets there. And doesn't start with a low we have and then denies its existence and just tries to wipe that out and sails off someplace else. It's something like a cul-de-sac, a blind alley, a box canyon. You come galloping into the messed universe full of vim and vigor, and all of a sudden, crash, there you are at the bottom of the tone scale. The cycle of action. Now, we have a cycle of action which goes backwards. It starts with stop, which is Homo sapiens, and ends with intention, which is your thetan bailed out all the way. Good workable cycle of action. What you're studying, if the truth be known, is a cycle of action which can apply because it is very carefully based upon the reversal of the cycle of action which made the mesh universe. And in order to make this new cycle of action, the cycle of action originally agreed to, broadly and generally, had to be completely understood. Now that we've got that cycle of action, we can turn it backwards. But it isn't backwards. It's forwards and upwards. Because our sole motive here isn't simply the reversal of a cycle of action. We're trying to establish a cycle of action in this universe which will work for individuals. And it works, Scientology 8. 8008 is a design of a new cycle of action. That's the design right there. It tells what the cycle of action goes to. An unapplied infinity of potential. And it tells how you get there. And it says you go up tone scale. You see, messed universe is infinity at the bottom of the tone scale. It's all motion. It's all matter. It's all somebody else's and none of your own. You see, actually, motion becomes an all motion, becomes a no motion. And that's matter. So you start there at the infinity, which is the meshed universe. The meshed universe is never more real than from four down. And you go back up the line of that, and you're going upscale all the time, and you're getting upscale there, and the meshed universe ceases to be completely at 40.0. Just isn't. For the preacher, you say you're bringing him up tone scale. You're bringing him up to the point where the messed universe is going to be zero. And you can stop him, or he can stop himself at about 20.0, and he's got a choice. He can contact the messed universe, he can have the messed universe, or on the other hand over here, he can have a universe of his own, or be part and parcel of another universe, or all those choices which I gave you the first part of this hour. Now, we've got that cycle of action. Now, it tells him quite additionally that his additional cycle of action depends upon these cycles of action. And that he has a pattern for the construction of his own universe, which he can do with pretty much as he likes, but it doesn't define what the infinity of his own universe would be, and it doesn't say that it has to be an all-motion thing at all. But it tells him that he can raise his own universe from zero and take it through to infinity. Now we've got it. So we've got this cycle of action. Now that's a cycle of action which would graph like this. So, of course, infinity would be all possible cycle of action. And when you say infinity of his own universe, he could make it any cycle of action. So the first infinity means all possible cycles of action or any other type of pattern or any other type of ritual or any other type of intention which he cares to engage in. Now we find the messed universe is most real down here at 0.0. Boy, there's you're really real when you're dead. And that goes on up the line up here. That would be infinity. And that goes on up the line up here to 20.0, which would be halfway between infinity and zero up here. And it would go on out, and at 40.0 you would have for the meshed universe, that's zero phi, infinity phi, you would have 40.0 up here at the top. That's out. Understand that? I mean, that's out of the universe. Now, that goes from here, then, for a zero of his own universe, we just have to reverse this thing, and let's say his own universe has a tone scale on an entirely different principle. We have a tone scale on this principle, which takes us from a 40.0 of his own universe to a zero of his own universe, or a zero of his own universe. I don't care which way it's put. So we've got this thing running from a zero, or nothing but space, or something for his own universe, he makes it out of space, down to there. And this, of course, for his own universe, could be called infinity. And for his own universe up here, could be called a zero. Well, it doesn't matter how I draw this. If you have any curiosity about that second graph, it's because you're trying to relate it to the first tone scale graph. And he could design a tone scale for his own universe, which would be a beauty. It could do anything, torsional spaced or quadrupeds or anything you want. But he doesn't have it now. That's a cinch. He doesn't have it now. So perhaps it's best to draw this thing this way. So it could go, and this would be ohm. Because certainly at 40.0, at 30.40, he can start toward the infinity of his own universe, can't he? And at zero here, 0.0 on this tone scale, he doesn't have one, does he? Because at zero, a man's hopes, dreams, illusions, and all those things which he graces the messed universe with are dead. They don't exist. Death comes about only when one is no longer able to place any of his own force, dream, hope, intention upon the messed universe. If you want to kill a man, the most effective way of killing a man may be with a shotgun. But that shotgun is telling him in a terribly brief instant that he has met something in the messed universe which he cannot overcome in terms of force. And if he's met that, he is dead. Very simple. Or you simply start in on him and start working on him when he's very small, and you say, you shouldn't imagine such things, you shouldn't do such things. You got to work hard now that you're married. You got to work hard, and you're going to do this, and you got to do that, and you expect certain things, and so on. And you've got to go through this, and you've got to go through that. And you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. So it gets up to the point of restriction. I had this mathematician one time. I told him about this, and he right away figured out something was called an abstract. And he found out that every time anybody spoke to him, they were trying to lay a restriction upon him of one sort or another. It had to do with a restriction. And so he suddenly recognized this, and with this clear, brilliant recognition, suddenly went up the pole, got up there to 800,000 feet with no parachute. It was quite somebody for quite a little while. It was a problem. He grabbed a hold of a girl who was married because he loved her, and he convinced her that this was the case, and she said, by golly, that is the case, and picked her up with the nape of the neck and went to another state, and they lived happily ever after. You just don't do that in this universe, you know. You don't take this girl, and she's married, and she's all pinned down, and she's got an identity and so forth, and you don't suddenly say, now look, do you know that everything everybody is saying to you is really an attempt to restrict you in some way or another? Now look, we can have a pretty good time of it here, and why don't you just come down to the train and pick up the kid and we'll leave. He's known her for maybe 24 hours. And they do. They've been very happy. You see, you'd expect this. The messed universe would tell you anything that starts like that will wind in disaster. Mm-mm. Anything which starts the other way is what winds up in disaster. You know, you meet somebody and then you know them for a long period of years, maybe 3 years, you have an engagement, and then he works very hard at a job in order to save up enough money to put the down payment down on a house. And then they finally get married and say everybody's consent and everybody's approval. And then they have some children with everybody's consent and everybody's approval. And then they work harder and harder, and they send the kids to college. When the kids get through college, they say, to hell with the old folks. And so on. And they finally wind up footsore and weary, but with this righteous feeling of, well, we did our best, and we have helped them all out, and now we too can pass away. That's practically what Mess says all around her, saying, we helped you out. We went to the end of the trail. It's got that sad, sad, remorseful feeling. Of course, there isn't a piece of Mess in the Mess universe that hasn't been abandoned so often. It's got that written all over it. So we've got here, then, Scientology 8-0-0-8 in the form of an action cycle, which gives us a process. And it said, this is a track. And if you go on this track, well, these are your potentialities. And if you like the other track, and if you think this messed universe is a wonderful place that you want to agree and agree and agree and agree and agree, brother, it's yours. If you just like this universe, that's up to you. That's thoroughly up to you. In view of the fact that there you are at 2.5 or 3.0 on the tone scale, and there you are at 3.0 on the tone scale, and you're perfectly agreeable, you think everything that's happening is all for the best, and you're perfectly happy, and it's all working out the way it should work out, and if you can find a fellow who is like that and who doesn't want to take this road, I'll give you a lot of mess as a reward, because I have not been able to find him. But he exists as a myth and an illusion. Now, a magician, getting back to cause and effect and Alistair's work, a magician postulates what his goal will be before he starts to accomplish what he is doing. The old magician was the great-great-great-grandfather of your modern stage magician. Your stage magician doesn't even know the old magician ever existed. And the stage magician gets up there and he waves this around, and he has a hat, and he has a wand, and he has this bric-a-brac of various sorts, and he doesn't really know where it came from. This is a great joke on him. These are pieces of ritual out of the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, and each one of them means something terribly specific, and the most awesome ritual in the world is associated with their use. And the magician was very ritualistic, and he would very carefully postulate what effect he was trying to achieve before he would be cause for that effect. That's the first thing he'd do. What am I trying to do? Then he would make a statement of what he was trying to do. And having made a statement of what he was trying to do, he would just then initiate the steps necessary to accomplish it. If one did not do this, one would inevitably fall into this trap. He would become the effect of his own cause, because what he had eventually accomplished would seem surprising to him and might be seem desirable as an effect upon him. So he carefully stayed out of that rat race. He had nothing further to do with it. And at any time that he achieved this effect, then he would say, you see, I achieved that effect. He was still caused to that effect. But a fellow who just flounders around and says, well, I think I'll do so-and-so and so-and-so, and we leave it all up to luck, and what do you know what happened? I finally wound up so-and-so and so-and-so, and isn't that cute of me? He gets over to a point of where he is being continually the effect of his own cause. And sure enough, then and there, we get a time illusion, because he becomes a thing more and more. He's an object, more and more and more and more an object. And, of course, he can only inevitably go down this tone scale till you get an infinity of meshed universe and a zero of personal cause. So you start out being a cause. Be sure you don't wind up as an effect. And the only way you can wind up as being an effect is forget that you wound up this effect over here.
You did it. Nobody else did it. You did it.
And as long as you know you did it, why, you're all right. Now, because a person suddenly says, well, all right, I take full responsibility for everything I've ever done, and I'm to blame. Well, you see, he didn't postulate what he was trying to do in the first place. So you're picking your preclear up where he sits as a sort of a pawn. He's just been shuttled around here and there and so on. He never really had any intention, and clearly stated anywhere along the line. Now, it's up to you. It's up to you to get him to state an intention. What is he trying to do? What does he want to become? You make him state. If you state it for him, and if you do, if you state it for him, then be sure to remember that you stated it for him. Be sure you know when he is finally super cleared or something of the sort that you did it. And if he suddenly comes around and blows your house down, as a result thereof, you have introduced some randomity that you did. But you shouldn't be in a situation where it would upset you any to have your house blown down. If you're going to go on up into altitudes like that, somebody comes around and blows your house down, so you put the house together again. Boom, you say the house is there. You say, what's the matter, boy? You're losing your voice? Now, here we have all up and down the scale, then, these various gradients, these cycles of action, and we find a cycle of action comes about because an individual does what? He starts in doing something, and he doesn't say what he's doing. Like the parson in the church, he asked the congregation if they liked his argufying and sputifying, and the whole church looked at him and kind of doubtfully, and finally the deacon said, well, we're very fond of your argufying and sputifying, but you don't show wherein. And the whole point of it is the fact that here's your guy going into action, 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 and he just don't show wherein at all. He's just in action. He takes somebody else and something else, and he gets kicked here, and he says, well, it's probably... He goes down and he eats a decayed whale upon the beach, and he gets a terrible bellyache, and he sits down upon the sand, a la Kipling, and he says, the gods have afflicted me. And every time he says, I'm an effect, I'm an effect, I'm an effect, I'm an effect, or realizing that he did it, I'm to blame, he digs himself further into the meshed universe cycle. And that cycle goes from space to object. And an object is matter, and things handle the object. The object doesn't handle other things. So there is your cycle. And it is a cycle of failure to postulate cause and recognize that one is the effect of cause. Now, you can start any time to do that because it's not an existence in time. It only becomes a time flow when one begins to abandon responsibility for the causes he postulated. The worst thing that could possibly happen to your preclear, one of the things that's really nice and hot to run on Homo sapiens, wonderful thing, are the times he denied that he'd said it when he had. The times when he denied himself. And when he denied himself, he was dead. And a lot of little mites dance around in this society, around people, and they want to say, one of them say all the time, admit you didn't say that. You have broken my heart. What you said was so terrible and so forth. Now tell me you didn't say that. You didn't mean that, did you? He said, you are easily the... And then they don't go around saying, I feel bad because he's postulated that I am that, or he's tried to direct me. No, they say, well, tell me you didn't mean it. Or the whole argument will resolve around. And finally, when, quote, peace is made, unquote, it will be on these lines. I didn't mean what I said. Oh, yes, he did. If he said, I meant what I said, and I meant every word of it. Just now, I think you're lovely and charming. He doesn't deny himself. You see, that in essence is honesty with himself. He has not abandoned his own beingness. Because at the moment he said, you are easily the... That was beingness. And it was beingness before, and it was beingness afterwards. But all of a sudden, he's taken a violent action point of beingness and intention. And a little while after that, he said, no, that wasn't I. So he's saying, any time I administer force or use force, even in the shadow of a communication line, that isn't I. And what do you know? He suddenly winds up as not being himself. He doesn't know who he is. And he'll come around and ask you pathetically, he'll ask you the most pathetic question. He'll say, could you tell me? Well, if I could just find out who I am, I think I would be all right. He'll pull that on you just continually. If I could just find out who I am. And the big joke is, he's him. He's asking, for instance, he's asking on this astonishing thing. He's saying, will you please tell me what names I have been assigned in the past? Would you please give me a list of the effects I have been? Will you please give me a list of the times when people have assigned to me an identity? In other words, when they have made an object out of me by giving me a name and a location. And they have given this to me, and I have these things now, so I now am. Oh, no, he isn't. That's the moment when he's not. He's not himself at all. He is a name. One of the slippiest tricks, again, in Kipling, that you can get a pre-clear to do is just start repeating his own name. Tell him to repeat his own name. Repeats his own name, repeats his own name. How am I? And he gets this horrible, funny state of being, but not identified. And it's an interesting experiment. If you get a little kid to do this, you'll talk him right out of this universe. You just say, now, what you say your name was? Johnny Jones, okay? Now, just start saying Johnny Jones. Kid says, Johnny Jones, Johnny Jones, Johnny Jones, Johnny Jones. The hell? Who am I? It'll just desensitize it. It wears his name out. Because that's just an identity, and therefore it's an object, so therefore it can be used up. But the one that can't be used up is his own beingness. Who is he? He's him. That's who he is. And as far as beingness is concerned, he's who he decides he is. He's not who somebody else decided he was. And every time he decides to be somebody that somebody else decided he was, he gives up his own beingness and becomes an object. The idea of naming is great magic in itself that the boys didn't cover in this dissertation at all. I'm not giving you data out of that area. Those boys were very cognizant of that one point. When thou dost not make a statement and clear intention of what thou art trying to become, thou unbecomest, bud. Do not be hoist by thine own petard. Do not suddenly pretend that you didn't have anything to do with bringing about what you have now found yourself surrounded with. That gives you time, you see. The upset of cause and effect, the upset of it, buries time. But the use of cause and effect brings it into being. And cause and effect, as it is deserted, brings about various states of being. And force, as it descends on the tone scale in the meshed universe, partakes more and more of solid character. And it gets solider and solider and solider and solider, and down at the bottom of the tone scale, your preclear couldn't quite know what to do with it, to handle a force band. To handle a piece of force, he'd think you needed a derrick. Really? You at least got to have a wire. You got to have a wire with great big insulators, and you got to have all sorts of things in order to get force from one place to another. It wouldn't occur to him that what he would do, the middle action of the band in action, he would say, let's see, they want some force flowing along this line or something of the sort. All right, ker-whap. He's got force flowing along that line. Oh, but brother. Or if he were a little higher on the tone scale, he'd say, oh, they need some force there? Well, okay, it's there. And it'd be there. Zong, 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 zong. Silly sounds to you, perhaps, but there's nothing easier to fool with than force, but there's nothing more incredible than force down at the bottom of the tone scale. Oh, boy, is anybody an effect to this stuff? You know, you take a lousy little 110 AC and you hook it in to the mouth of a Homo sapiens and he'll complain. Now, this force as it goes downscale is descriptive of certain states of being. And the first one is how much agreement, as you go down from 40 down, is how much agreement has a person had or used. And the next one is how much communication does he enter into. And the third one is what is his state of affinity or emotion. And up here, it's sensation, way up here, and then it becomes affinity, as we call the emotional band. And right in here, we're quite coarse, very accustomed to what Homo sapiens uses as part of that emotional band. And a fellow really doesn't think that a person has other emotions than this. He thinks that he knows something about, quote, the emotion spirit of play. He's a complete foreigner to it. He knows that it's lots of fun to go out and play a game. And sometimes when he is 30 or something like that, he'll go out and play catch with his boy or something of the sort, you see. He knows what play is. It's something you work at. And he has the spirit of work down pat. Well, that is the emotion called effort. But the spirit of play, he doesn't know too much about. And you suddenly spring a pre-clear into spirit of play, and he says, my God, where's this been? I got a ghosty feeling that when I was a little kid, I used to feel this once in a great while. Once in a great while, something like this. But this is really something. And he will suddenly recognize that this has more intensity to it than sex. Oh. Sensation, spirit of play. So we have those various things that come down tone scale from here to here. And those things, the communication ability, and the agreement level, and the communication, agreement, and emotional or sensational state, the three of them exist at any level. They are a constant. They are interdependent at a constant, and we get the triangle ARC. Now, ARC, in the past, we used as an interrelated experience. We knew that affinity was related to communication, and that these two were related to agreement, that you could not go into communication with something without at least partially agreeing with it. You agreed with anything to some degree that you went into communication with. And to agree with something, you had to go into communication with it. You had to agree or disagree with something, and that was very certain. Disagree with it or agree with it in order to be in communication with it. You had to have something about that. And so you had your communication band over here was dependent upon the emotional band, the amount of communication you would enter into, and the type and variety of that communication was established by the sensation, the emotion, the affinity, the way you felt about this. And so you had your interconnected things there. You couldn't agree with somebody without going into communication with him and having some emotional upset, even if it was something you were fondly calling no emotion about it. I didn't get upset about it. I held myself in and controlled myself beautifully. I had no feeling about it at all. Oh, yeah, well, that's a sensation. So we had ARC, ARC, ARC. So at any point on this, from 0, 0, from minus 8.0, right on up, at any level, we have an ARC and an ARC and an ARC and an ARC. And for any level of that tone scale, we've got ARC. Well, looks like we have to get into something little hotter. We haven't tied, I just say, there's ARC at any point of that tone scale, and we don't tie those things in any closer to the mass universe than just ARC. So we better tie those in. And we better tie them in, but good. And it doesn't take me forever to tie them in, fortunately. Because I finally hooked them up into terms of conditions of energy. And ARC come to mean suddenly conditions of energy. Now, we'd better look at energy and find out what are the three component parts of energy. We're going to do that. Now, we found that energy requires space, and it's a particle, and it's action, and it becomes an object. We found that does it energy, but what do you know? There's three varieties of that happening. There's the big variety of there being just a flow, and then there's a dispersal, and then there's a ridge. Now, we get here a flow. These are the three kinds of energy, three actions of energy. That's a flow. Now, you understand that that could be a smooth wave, as it is, a sine wave or something of the sort, or it can be a noise wave. Or it can be a complex wave here. Something that goes like this. Doesn't matter what kind of a complex wave it would be. Any one of those things are flows. And it really doesn't matter whether that is a small wave or a great big wave like this. Anything like that is a flow. And your flow goes from this point to this point. Point one, point two. You see? Now, we could say that an effort flow was a big, heavy wave that went like this, and that it was an effort flow, so if there was... Did you ever notice, by the way, that somebody trying to pick up something heavy trembles? He's got a shake to it. He can't hold it very stable. And you get this kind of a noise wave going along with an effort band. You get a noise wave going along with it. You get a tremble that'll go along with it. Now, all of these things can be graphed on a cathode ray tube, Kinnick potometer, numbers of other ways of doing it. They can follow magnetic patterns on pieces of tape. You can measure these things with meters. It doesn't matter whether they're a wave of the sea, a rarefaction condensation wave, such as that passes through air, whether or not it's the passage of a particle, is in an X-ray machine, because that is that's an interesting one. That's a particle going like this in a motion, and it's flying from here to there. Bottom here is a particle. In other words, to have a particle, you would say it's going zzzz, and then we send it going zoop. So it's a specialized kind of a wave, and therefore, when the professors stand behind their benches in physics classes and they say, well, tell me, is it a particle or is it a wave? They're full of beans. They're just full of beans. A straight line is inevitably a type of wave. You couldn't possibly have a straight line that wasn't a wave, because a wave essentially is a path of flow. And you wouldn't have any better or more useful definition than to say a wave was a path of flow or a pattern of flow. And by God, the day that you can take a straight line out of the category of patterns, I haven't seen yet. So is it a particle or is it a flow? They're just obfuscating themselves. You know, they keep changing their minds about it, which is the most humorous of all. One day, one year, it's fashionable to say X-rays are flows. And the next year, it's fashionable to say X-rays are actually particles in motion, which are traveling in straight lines. and the next year they change their minds again. They say a photon is traveling in a straight line, so therefore it's a particle flow. It is not a wave motion. Oh, no. These are not workable definitions, and that's all you want in a definition. Anything that's flowing on a wave is a particle flow. You take an electric line, and it has electrons in it, and those electrons are going brrr. They're a particle of flow. They're going like mad in there. And you get the number of inches which an electron moves on that electrical flow that's coming in there now during a day. You can measure with a tape measure. It isn't flying down that line like water through a pipe. It's being kicked. And it's like you rack up a flock of billiard balls here. In order to have billiard balls, you've got to have things that are in motion. They're not statics. We're studying statics and kinetics. Only we're really studying statics and kinetics. And the old boys really just pretended they were. They said, you see this object? It is sitting there, isn't it? All right, there it sits. And therefore, it's a static. And you say, oh, no, where do you get this? That thing has eight motions already if it's on the surface of Earth. Well, there's the motion of the sun going around, Earth going around the sun. There's the motion of the variation of the position of Earth with relationship to the sun called the orbit. There is the rotation. It, by the way, is a changing motion. It's not a stable motion, and there is, in addition to that, the spin of the Earth around its axis, and that ball sitting there statically, motionless, you see, is traveling already, being on the surface of the Earth by one motion alone, is traveling at almost 1,000 miles an hour. Anytime you can show me something is going 1,000 miles an hour and say that thing is standing still, you'd have to be a better magician than a physics professor. Because a static would simply mean something, by definition, that had no motion in it. They define the word static as something without motion. That's great. Kinetic is motion. Something is moving. Our potentiality of motion. You look right there in Webster's, and you look in the physics books, and you look every place, and it says a static is something that isn't moving, and a kinetic is something moving, or can move. And there it is. And then they show you a ball, which is sitting on the surface of Earth, moving in eight different directions simultaneously. There's the tip of the solar system. There are all sorts of motions with relationship to other spaces. Completely in addition to that, let's take this billiard ball and look inside of it, its own structure, and we find out that we could actually trace the pattern of molecules and atoms through that billiard ball, and they're going like mad inside the billiard ball, and the particles which make up the molecules and atoms of each of the molecules and atoms are going like mad in the molecules and atoms. And yet somebody tells you that thing is not in motion. Well, brother, it is in motion. Because that's motion itself, and by definition, motion. So when we study a static, for heaven's sakes, a static would have to be something that had no wavelength. It would have to have no volume. It would actually have no location in space. This would be your static. And it would be nothing there. And that would be a static. So we're studying a static and a kinetic. Just above 40.0, we have a static, a real static. And when we get down to MEST, down there, low part of the scale, we're studying a kinetic. So we're studying the science of static and kinetics in Scientology. And that science has not been outlined in the subject of physics. It's very, very amusing. It's very amusing, the limitations which Homo sapiens puts upon himself. He sets out to study the science of static and kinetics, and then he doesn't define a kinetic and he doesn't define a static. Except he puts it in the dictionary, it's exactly what they are, and then he never tries to study them. Yeah, he says, well, he said all his time what a static is, and then he's never studied static. All right, let's take a look at this then. We find out that this flow is a characteristic, and that this flow can exist at any level of the whole wave scale. And the wave scale can go from a wavelength of 1 over infinity down to the wavelength of infinity. But the second you say it has zero, it becomes a static and does not become a wave motion. That's simplicity, isn't it? So we're studying from static to kinetic, and we're really studying it. We're finding out some terribly interesting things, all of which could have been found out much earlier.
That's a flow. Now, an aesthetic wave would be a flow, an emotional level could be a flow, effort could be a flow, electric lights are a flow, supersonic is a flow, X-ray machines are a flow, the path of wave motion through the ocean is a flow, the path of wave compaction, rarefaction, as you go through a block of ice is a flow. Doesn't matter what wavelength. A radio station sitting out here and madly emanating electronic magnetic waves is establishing a flow. And those are all wavelengths, because they're all measurable in terms of wavelength. In physics, you try to divide these things into rarefaction and condensation formations and actual flow formations. And yet they show you what they have as actual flow formations or rarefaction condensation formations. That's what's interesting. Rarefaction condensation takes place in electric light line in order to get electricity to flow. Okay? You see, another thing, funny thing about radio, it's going through space where there is nothing. And it's doing rarefaction condensation, goes through space where there is nothing. That's why the old boy said there has to be such a thing as ether. It doesn't have to be anything like ether. All you have to do is put out a big fan of ion beams of some sort or another, throw out ions of some sort, which they probably have not described adequately yet, and then you just rarefy and condense these ions as you go through, and you have a perfectly adequate wave flow. See what we mean by flow? All right, let's put flow under one heading. How does it, what is it in experience? It's communication. Let's go on to the next one. We have here a ridge. A ridge is formed from two flows. And these two flows hitting will pile things up. If you were to take a stroboscopic picture of throwing a bucket of water against the side of a house, you would find that at the moment it hit the side of the house, that there was a great big gob of water standing there. There was a lot of water there. It's standing there in a mass. The water stops flowing when it leaves the lip of the bucket and it hits the side of the house and it goes splash. And then it stands there in a mass for an instant and then trickles on down the wall. Pulled by gravity, not by any necromancy. It's just pulled by the agreement called gravity. And this goes down the wall, and what do you have left? A dry wall? No, you don't. You have a wet wall. And that wet wall is a remaining part of a flow which is impinged upon the wall of a house and which in itself is embryonically a ridge. Now, if you were to take two buckets of water and you were to throw them at each other, you would have two flows which would be meeting in midair, and if you'd have a stroboscopic camera there, you would be able to study the pattern they made and the wall they made when they hit each other. The two flows hit each other and they make a wall. Now, if we take electronics, the boys just got wise to this not too long ago. Very, very, very new, newer than our material. No coincidence in this at all. I mean, the fact that we've been studying ridges like this and have been talking about electronic densities. Because this other stuff really is no relationship. Because there's some very old writers that suppose something like this might happen. Well, we can prove it happens. You take an electronic beam of some sort, and you pour it in from the right, which is flow A here, and you take an electronic beam and you pour it in from the left, and we call that B, and if you hit them one against the other, crash, they stand for a moment. You turn the beams off, and they'll stand there. Isn't that peculiar? You've got a persistence of crash. Good name for it, just a persistence of crash. Now, if you have a whole lot of electronic beams with lots of horsepower in it and a whole lot of their time, means a whole lot of force in it, and they hit each other and they ran and ran and ran and ran and ran and ran and ran, the persistence of crash would eventually become matter. And that persistence of flow hitting each other would take on the emotional aspects of such things as apathy, anger, conservatism, in other words, those things which hold. The formation of matter could well be accounted for by electronic flows in space
hitting, 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 and this persistence continuing and continuing until at last you have something which is in apathy. And that something which is in apathy is a ridge, which becomes matter. So when you have that flow hitting that flow, now there are numbers of ways you can make ridges. We have here what you call a dispersal. A dispersal is a specialized kind of flow, but that's your next type here. There is where you're getting an outrush from, and oddly enough, we will just have to classify under dispersals the implosions. This is an X, and this is an M. Here everything is dispersing down to a point because it's particles which are dispersing, you understand. This is not a picture of a... That's not the name of a pattern so much as the name of the behavior of particles in space. And those are going from where they are at a mad rush. And they could be coming down to this point in the middle, and that would be implosion, or they would be going out from this point, and that would be an X dispersal. You could probably call an impersal and an expersal. If you wanted to invent a lot of words, we don't happen to need the language. Now, where that, let's say, two dispersals hit each other, and they hit each other, materials rushing out here like mad, and so on. And here's another one. Bang, 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 bang. We get this thing floating out from the middle here, and where they hit in the center area, the impact of energy together will again make a ridge. But what is that? That's just a number of flows at random hitting one to the other. Now we can combine an implosion and an explosion in such a way as to get a turbulence. We're getting someplace, aren't we? We can get a turbulence of electronic flow, and where you get a consistent turbulence of electronic flow, you get a ridge. The three actual levels of energy behavior are flows, ridges, and dispersals. But a dispersal, as you can see, is a specialized multiple flow, just because a flow is parallel. But you can call those the three. Now, a flow comes along here, and a flow comes along this way, and it's behaving itself very nicely, and it all of a sudden hits an existing ridge, and it'll go splash. See, it's going in that direction, and it's goes splash back this way and leaves a certain amount of its energy residual here on a ridge. Ridges are best formed when two flows hit, but we'll say there's just something there already, and it hits that, and you get that thing flowing. So we'll see here that the actual pattern of progress of electronic current is from a flow to a dispersal to a ridge. See, you get a dispersal at the moment of impact of the flow. So you could categorize this as the three types of flows here, three types would be characteristics of energy. I should be very precise about this. Flows, dispersal, and ridge. Energy, as it begins to form, goes into flows, dispersals, and ridge. At the top of the tone scale, you have the unimaginable, very, very, very tiny flow dispersal ridge, which makes, what do you know, a particle. Particle consists of a flow dispersal ridge, flow dispersal ridge, flow dispersal ridge. And is himself then a particle. And it's doing all sorts of weird things inside itself. Now your next step down from a particle, you would start coming in wider space, and this wider space would be particles which were doing flows, dispersals, ridges, flows, dispersals, ridges, flows, dispersal ridges. When I was talking about harmonics a little earlier, I was talking about less and less heavily formed ridges up the scale. A ridge is fairly light at the beginning. Now we get the ridge itself doing some flowing and some dispersing and a new ridge. And we come down tone scale. So we plot the tone scale from 40 down in terms of flow, dispersal, ridge. What do you know? As being that pattern, which is coming down there. Now we have a flow, dispersal, ridge,
Newton, and we get a flow, dispersal, ridge, and we get a flow, dispersal, ridge. Get that. Is that gradient scale? You're looking at the construction of matter. Flow dispersal ridge, flow dispersal ridge, flow dispersal ridge. Now you're also looking at positive negative plate voltages. Every time this thing hits, you get a ridge at one potential, positive, let's say, that's Havis. And the next one down from that is don't Havis. And the next one is Havis, the next one's don't Havis, and you get a continual interchange of energy flows, dispersals, and ridges up and down the tone scale. That's why you have these dichotomies. Positive and negative poles make electrical flows, and they can make them at any level of the tone scale. And why, then, is this so important? It's terribly important because we treat those things in the human experience as sensation, and we therefore have the gradient scale of sensation. So when we look at this flow dispersal ridge proposition, we are getting then sensation continually all the way down the line as different things, and more solid things. And any sensation could be categorized as a dispersal or as a ridge or as a flow. And what is agreement and what's reality? That is the direction of the flow. Reality is the direction of flow. If your disagree is flowing out, your agree is flowing in. If it's flowing in, you get reality of agreement. If it's flowing out, you've got a reality of disagreement. Then direction of flow is reality. Whether it's a flow, dispersal, or a ridge is an affinity. And whether or not it is at one point or another on the band scale, which I showed you is at right angles to this, tells you what kind of communication it is. At the level of light, it's sight. At the level of sound, it happens to be hearing. At the level of tactile, it's another thing. At the level of effort, it's another thing. And each one of those is being used as a perception band. And the perception band is present at each level of these things. But where it's a ridge, it's blind. Where it's a flow, it can be seen. Where it's a dispersal, it's scattered and changing. And so as you go up tone scale with the preclear, you're getting these three conditions in terms of perception all the way up the tone scale. And they're getting less and less and less, but they turn from excellent to poor for each band. And then they'll turn good again, but they'll turn better. And then they turn poor. And then they turn better than that. And then they turn a little less poor. And then they turn much better than that. And what are you studying then when you're studying communication? You are studying what point of the tone band and whether or not the affinity of it is a flow, a dispersal, or a ridge. And those three interactions, which we'll cover much, much more thoroughly, are then the three characteristics of ARC as measured up against space, energy, and objects. And we have then human experience. That'll be all. Thank you.